It's the Burt Cohen Show. And in America, religion has always been a part of who we are. Like it or not, it's something that gets brought up in politics quite often. Of course, we are a secular country. We are not a religious state. But there's a lot of people in America who care very, very deeply about religion and spirituality and having some sense of God in their lives. And a lot of Americans are Catholics. I don't happen to be, but there's been quite a brouhaha that's started very recently when, in late April, the Vatican issued a decree. It was a reprimand to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, the main association of American Catholic nuns. And I'm very pleased to have with us Mary Johnson, who served for 20 years in the Missionaries of Charity, which was founded by Mother Teresa. Johnson worked in Rome for 15 years and in North America for the other five. She came to know Mother Teresa personally. Well, again, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this issue. Tell us about this reprimand to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. What did it say, and did nobody see it coming?
Well, Bert, people did see it coming. The Vatican did give warning signs. In 2001, the Vatican told the Leadership Conference of Women Religious that, according to the Vatican's point of view, they hadn't spoken out enough against gay rights. They hadn't spoken out enough on the fact that, in their mind, that the Catholic Church is the only way to salvation. They had these various doctrinal concerns that they voiced as early as 2001. And then in 2008, they announced that they were indeed investigating the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. There's been tension between the Vatican and American nuns for a long time. I think a lot of it boils down to the fact that American sisters speak their minds. And they're very much working every day with people on the margins. And I think the view of life when you're caring for the sick, when you're there sitting right next to someone who doesn't have the money to pay their rent, it's a lot different view that the sisters have than the bishops and the pope and the cardinals in Rome who sit at a distance and make moral pronouncements.
Now, so what more specifically did this reprimand say?
Right. So what this document did, it's called a doctrinal assessment, and it was issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And it had five basic points at the end, saying that the Vatican was appointing an archbishop aided by two other bishops, all of them Americans, to oversee the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, to rewrite their statutes, to determine who they could and couldn't have to speak at their conferences, to look at all of their publications, etc. They appointed these bishops to oversee the sisters because the document said, while the sisters had been doing very good work, they had not been vocal enough in opposition to gay rights, in defending, according to the bishops, the sanctity of human life from conception to natural death, that the sisters had been, that the document accuses the sisters of a radical feminism and of supporting the ordination of women.
Now, it's been said that the nuns were accused of being radical feminists. I'm not sure if that actual phrase, radical feminist, is in there.
It is, actually. That is
how?
The phrase. They are accused of a certain radical feminism. Those are the words that are used.
I've not generally had that impression of nuns, and again, I'm not Catholic, but I always thought that nuns were, you know, pretty among the more conservative, peaceful members of our society, not generally stirring things up, but certainly caring for the poor has always been the case. Does the term radical feminist really apply? I suppose it's a question of perspective.
It's all a question of perspective, and it's also a question that must be framed in this discussion by the fact that all of the official power, all of the structural power in the Catholic Church is held in the hands of ordained men, and that they see this, or they proclaim it anyway, as being God's will, that God has made the church this way, that Jesus didn't ordain women, and that all of the power, the institutional power, rests in the hands of men. And whenever these men who have that power feel threatened by women, then it comes across to them as a sort of radical feminism. What the sisters are doing is speaking up for the rights of women in various ways, just by their work, basically, by the fact that they educate women, by the fact that they care for the health of women. The one thing that I think the Pope and the bishops have never really been able to forgive is the fact that in the late 70s, when Pope John Paul II mm-hmm. came to the United States, he was greeted at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., by Sister Teresa Kane, who at that time was the head of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. And one of the things she said in her greeting was that she called the church to a greater openness in considering women's place in ministering in the church, even perhaps to the ordination of women. And that she did this publicly in a very civil way, just open. Let us have this dialogue. The Pope didn't like that. And one of the things that the document quotes is the fact, the document cites, is the fact that the sisters have never apologized for this thing, which took place in 1979. And they're still, the bishops are still holding on to this as some sort of great insult, which has not yet been righted. And in 1983, perhaps, the early 80s, after this incident, Pope John Paul II issued a decree saying that the question of women's ordination was settled in the church, it was not open for discussion, and forbade anyone to bring up the topic even. So that's how much they are threatened by the idea of possibly opening the priesthood to women. But as far as the sisters being radical feminists, I think we have to realize one of the things that's going on in the background of this discussion is the fact that there are actually two conferences of women religious in the United States. As you mentioned, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious represents over 80% of the nuns in the United States. The other less than 20% is represented by a group called the Council of Major Superiors of Women Religious, and it's a far more conservative group. And there's been some tension there. The Vatican favors that smaller, more conservative group.
Uh-huh. We are talking, if you just tuned in, with Mary Johnson, who was a nun for 20 years, and we're talking about the recent decree. Would you say, Mary, it's been said that the Vatican is trying to muzzle American nuns. Is that an accurate word, muzzle?
Yes, in the sense that they don't want the sisters to speak up on issues in any way that might be different from what the bishops are saying. I think that one of the most recent things that happened was the Affordable Care Act, when there was a big discussion. The bishops kind of came to the conclusion that the Affordable Care Act provided funding for abortion and was therefore unacceptable. The sisters who work very closely with such issues, the Sisters of Network, which is a social justice lobby made up of many Catholics, examined the issues and came to the conclusion that the bill actually did not change federal funding for abortion in any significant way. And in fact, the Ohio State Supreme Court agreed with the sisters. The sisters had that correct interpretation, that this was not even an issue in the document. But the bishops were so opposed to the Affordable Care Act, that they were furious when the sisters came out in support of it. And the sisters who work every day with people who don't have health care coverage, they're working every day next to people who need that sort of help. And the sisters supported the bill, and the bill passed, and the bishops have been furious about that.
Long memories. And why did you choose to become a nun, and why did you leave the church?
Well, I became a nun in 1977. I was 19 years old. When I was in high school, I came from a very religious family, not a traditionally Catholic family in the sense of praying the rosary every day or things like that. But we did definitely go to church every Sunday, often during the week. My parents belonged to the Catholic Charismatic Movement, which is a form of like personal prayer, close and praying for people for healing and things like that. So this was very much a part of my daily life, the whole relationship, personal relationship with God. And one day I read an article on Mother Teresa in Time magazine, and as I read it, it was like a fire burning inside of me, and somehow I felt, as a 17-year-old, that this was God speaking to me somehow. I read about this woman who was taking the dying off the streets of Calcutta, finding babies in dustbins and bringing them back and rescuing them, and I just felt like this is what I need to be doing too. And so I joined the sisters shortly after that, really sensing that somehow as a call from God. And I lived it out for 20 years. The Missionaries of Charity, this group of sisters founded by Mother Teresa of Calcutta, is definitely on the conservative, traditional end of religious life in the church, of, you know, that the nuns in the church. And I didn't really quite realize all of that at the time, how so much pressure would be put on as far as an anti-intellectual bias. We had a very small selection of books from which we could read for half an hour every day. We were eventually, when Mother Teresa got older and older and she couldn't quite handle all of the day-to-day workings of the group, two sisters kind of took over and pulled the group very, very far in a conservative direction. And as I was becoming more open-minded, the group was somehow becoming more closed-minded. And I see so many echoes of my experience there as to what's happening here with the American sisters, which I think is one of the reasons this issue resonates so much with me.
Well, did Mother Teresa, did she threaten the hierarchy of the church at all? I mean,
not at all. Mother Teresa was actually, John Paul II used to call Mother Teresa my best ambassador. He would send her to places that he couldn't go, to China, to Eastern Europe at a time when he couldn't go there. He and Mother Teresa were very, very close, and she would, for example, he sent her to Ireland when there was a referendum that on whether divorce should be legalized or not, and Mother Teresa gave talks on that. And Mother Teresa always, always stood on the side of the official church. This was just her reflex, I think. She was born in 1910 in Albania, and the church really was everything to Mother Teresa. And she's a very complicated question when it comes to Mother Teresa's relationship with the church, especially, I think, in two ways. That the first, that she really did want to become a saint, and not just a saint in the sense of someone who was doing good, but an officially recognized, canonized saint. Several of the things that she said and did just kind of made that very clear. And, of course, in order for that to happen, you have to be in line with the official teaching of the church. So that was one thing that was going on in Mother Teresa. And the other thing that was happening, which was something that was not widely known at all during her lifetime, but came out 10 years later when her private letters were published to her spiritual directors, was the fact that Mother Teresa had many, many doubts. Early on, she says, you know, like, is God really there? And she describes these feelings of torment and torture in her soul. And she was told, basically, not to look at those doubts. that those experiences of pain and confusion were just things that brought her close to God. She was like Jesus on the cross, crying out, "My God, why have you abandoned me?" And because Mother Teresa wasn't encouraged, in fact, she was very much discouraged from ever examining any of those doubts, she became very dogmatic. And whatever the church said, she just kind of rubber-stamped it, very passionately rubber-stamped it. So she definitely was not in any trouble, you know, with the hierarchy.
So then there is, well, is there a vast significant change between Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI? I mean, he is said to be more authoritarian. Is that part of the change, or is it more of a continuation of tradition of the Vatican men ruling?
I think, you know, especially the continuum between John Paul II and Benedict XVI is a very smooth flowing one. Because Benedict was part of John Paul's administration, if you might want to use that term. Benedict was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, this same branch of the Vatican that has issued this new assessment of American sisters. Benedict was known as the enforcer, even while he was Cardinal Ratzinger, before he became Pope. And he did that during the time of John Paul II. Those two were working together, in a sense. And now, I do see it just as a continuation. And the church is, I believe, becoming more and more authoritarian in the sense that all of the bishops who are serving now throughout the world have been appointed by very conservative popes. And one of the reasons that they were appointed was because these popes felt that they were adequately conservative, adequately orthodox, according to their ideas. So at that institutional level of the church, there's not a whole lot of disagreement, of challenging. There are people who tend very much to the conservative side.
Well, my impression is that all nuns, in becoming nuns, agree to take a vow of obedience, submission of intellect and will to the Vatican authority. Don't nuns therefore have a responsibility to simply obey and promote church teaching without question? Isn't this understood when they become a nun?
Nuns do definitely take a vow of obedience, but it is not a vow of obedience to the Vatican. It's not a vow of obedience to submit mind and heart to the decisions of the bishops. That is not what the meaning of that vow of obedience is. The sisters take a vow to obey God as they understand God speaking to them, through their own religious superiors, yes, through the church, but ultimately that vow is not made to any human being. It's a vow made to God. It's a vow, and in the Catholic Church, the primacy of conscience, until very recently, was always seen as something extremely important. St. Thomas Aquinas, who is the most revered theologian in the Catholic Church, said that it would, suppose a person had what he would call an erroneous conscience. A person believed that something wasn't sin, but actually it was sin, that the person should follow their conscience because it was their conscience that would decide before God whether they were actually doing right or not. It's that personal, that voice of God speaking in what the Vatican Council called the innermost sanctuary of the human heart, that's the conscience. That is the supreme authority, and not vowing obedience to any human being, but to God. And the sisters have been so faithful to their struggle to discern God's voice and to be faithful to that. It would be far easier in many ways to merely agree with the Vatican about everything. It would cause them a lot less trouble, that's for sure. But because they are women who value that faith and that voice of God speaking within them, they find their moral center there.
I wonder if some of the bishops and the people in power in the Vatican, the men, feel like, well, the God can speak to them, but not to women. I mean, there does seem to be a very, very clear and, you know, unmistakable difference that men have the authority, and the women are supposed to accept that authority. Is that a false impression that I've had all these years?
No, I believe that impression is fairly consonant with what the, you know, the teaching authority says.
Yeah.
It's not what most Catholics in the pews believe.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you go and ask, as many surveys have recently, you know, ask the average American who sits in a Catholic church on a Sunday morning what they think about women's ordination, the overwhelming majority agree that women should be ordained. They don't see any barrier to that. They want a greater place for women in the church. And if you look, I mean, the women are the ones who have sustained the church in so many ways. The mothers who teach their children to pray, who bring them to church, just, you know, starting from that very beginning, the women's place is so important. And in fact, there are more sisters in the United States church than there are priests.
Yes.
You know, the women are just so important, and most Catholics that you would meet every day would agree with that. But those in power see it differently, and I think that, you know, when you have power in any situation, in any institution, you do what you can to hold on to it. That's kind of the nature of the thing. It's not a Christian thing to do, but we are all very human, and it's easy to fall into that trap. Hmm. When you have power, you want to keep it.
I'm reminded of a quote from Harry Truman, or at least attributed to Harry Truman. It's amazing how much you can get done if you don't care who gets the credit. It shows.
Isn't that the truth?
You know, and the fact that there's a large majority of religious women, you know, as compared to priests, they're getting the work done. And, you know, they connect with the community. They certainly
Absolutely.
Do. They certainly do. You say that the Vatican demands sharp ideological purity. Sisters often find, as we were saying, that real-world solutions involve a great deal of risky, messy gray, and that there are two ideas of what the church is. I wonder if you could talk about some of that divide in the ideological purity and differences of pictures of what the church is and should be.
I think the easiest way to do that is by telling you what happened in Arizona a few years ago.
Okay, thank you.
Sister Margaret McBride worked on an ethics committee in a Catholic hospital there. There was a woman who was brought in. She was already the mother of, I believe, three small children. It might have been four. I think it was three. This woman was pregnant. The doctors diagnosed her with a condition which they said that the only way to save the life of this mother was to terminate the pregnancy.
Oh, my.
It's a very rare condition. Certainly it's not something that happens every day. But that's the way that the determination of the doctors in this Catholic hospital, that that was the only way to save this woman's life, and that there was no way to save, to forfeit the mother's life and save the child's life. That was not an option. So Sister Margaret McBride agreed with to allow the doctors to go forward to do what they could to save this woman's life, this woman who already had small children. As soon as the Bishop of Phoenix found out, he excommunicated her immediately, saying that, you know, she has done this sin of colluding in an abortion. And because the bishops are there looking at the ideological purity, they have just these very black and white ideas. And sisters are on the ground working with people who are affected and who realize, you know, the sisters see that those ideological ideas, as much as they value the sanctity of life, when it comes down to very concrete instances, there are sometimes compromises that have to be made. Sometimes there are these inescapable human tragedies, and the bishops haven't been able to see through to really understand that or appreciate that and continually come down on the side of doctrine and of dogma, and not necessarily of real people.
And I'm reminded of a case of there was an Indiana woman named Emily Herks who filed a lawsuit saying she was fired from her job teaching at a Catholic school and denounced as a grave immoral sinner by the parish pastor after she used fertility treatments to try to get pregnant with her husband. And most people, I think, the church is obviously quite serious about being pro-life, and that's why it's very admirably, I believe, against the death penalty.
Yes.
Infertility. I mean, people want to have children. They want to, this I always thought was a value of the church, and it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but most Americans who are Catholics value family and
absolutely
creating life.
And it goes to the bishop's preoccupation with sex,
yes,
actually.
Yes.
Just to be very frank, if you look at the sexual teachings of the church, because for them this in vitro fertilization is connected with that. The reason they object to it is because this is not, according to them, a natural act, that something is interfering. And it speaks again to this ideological purity. For the bishops, for any sexual act to be considered legitimate, it has to be between two married people and open to procreation and without any sort of interference of any sort. And that's why they don't approve in vitro fertilization, which, as you said, is quite a paradox for someone, for a church that says they have family values. And I think that this is it's a good illustration, because the sisters are coming from a place of values.
Yes,
and values
clearly
get expressed in many different ways. And the bishops are coming from a place of rules and a place of trying to keep everybody in line. So it's two very, very different conceptions.
Wow. Interesting. I mean, the word conception, obviously, is a big one, too.
Yes.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Mary Johnson about the Vatican crackdown on American nuns. How many nuns are there in America now? And I wonder what the average age might be. And the reason,
this is definitely another significant fact. And
right.
I'm glad that...
I mean, how many younger women are willing to make the required sacrifices for a church doing this kind of thing?
Yeah. Right now, there are about 55,000 American nuns in the United States, and their average median age is 74.
Oh, my. That's older than I would have guessed.
Yes, 74. And as you said, American women entering now, I don't think it's really, to tell the truth, so much a question of how much they're willing to sacrifice. I find among young people still there are many who hold to very high ideals and are willing to dedicate themselves to something they see as worthwhile. But there's another question, and that's, will I give my entire life to an institution that devalues women? What young woman is going to give herself? Perhaps she wants to give herself to God, to service, to people, but to do that in an institution in which she knows she will never be given any sort of institutional power, any sort of way to influence things, and that all of the higher realms there are completely closed to her. I think that has a lot more to do with the fact that women aren't entering so much. And then there's the very interesting fact, also undeniable, that the more conservative spectrum of sisters of American religious are attracting younger vocations. And I think this is kind of what happened in my story. You know, there are young women who are looking for a different sort of lifestyle, something just kind of countercultural in a sense. I mean, becoming a sister is a very countercultural thing. You're giving up family, you're giving up career in a sense, you're giving up
stuff,
any sort of riches,
right.
And you're devoting yourself to a life of service. And the sisters at the more conservative end kind of do that in a more obvious way. They all wear religious habits. Most of the sisters of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious don't wear distinctive religious dress as we normally think of it. They might have a cross, or some of them might have a veil, but not the full religious habit thing. So that the sisters on the more conservative end are more obvious. They have a deeper, not deeper, but a more regulated prayer life, something that comes with a very strict schedule that can be adhered to. There's a certain sort of discipline there.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to live more separately. Some of the the more progressive sisters, the more liberal sisters live in different places, in apartments or in a homeless shelter or just very close to the poor. And the sisters on the more conservative end may live sometimes in poor neighborhoods or not, mm-hmm. but tend to live at a remove. And there is an appeal to a group that has a strong sense of group identity that's easily identifiable. When I joined the Missionaries of Charity, I knew that I would be able to do things with these sisters working together that I could not do on my own. And I didn't have such a draw to the more liberal American sisters who weren't so obvious, maybe, about what they were doing. I think there's kind of a romantic sort of draw also to the more conservative, very disciplined, very structured, very traditional lifestyle. But then what happens is that that sort of traditional, very conservative lifestyle very often comes connected with obedience is the highest virtue. And you may never be asked what sort of work you would like to do, what sort of gifts that you might like to bring to the community. You may actually have ideas of ways to serve better that are continually squelched because all the good ideas are supposed to come from the top, not from down. I found that the sisters in the more conservative groups are not developing as human beings in the same sort of way as I find among sisters in the more progressive groups. And perhaps if I had joined one of those more progressive groups, I might still be there now. Who knows? Because one of the reasons I had to leave was because I did feel crushed. I felt suffocated as an individual. And that's not at all what I see in these more progressive groups that belong to the leadership conference.
And I would think that, and again, I may be wrong, and again, I'm not Catholic, but that, you know, we all humans, we are, if you believe in God, as I do, that there is God in each one of us, and that, you know, we need to feel that and be connected with that. And
I think that's very much a tenet of the more progressive sisters and of most Catholics. That you know, everybody has something there to contribute.
I would think so. And, you know, the idea of the future of the church must be thought about on both sides of this very, very big issue. I can see the male leadership in the Vatican feeling like, you know, by casting doubt on church doctrine, that the authority of the church and the future of Catholicism is threatened. And yet, on the other hand, I can see that, you know, if the as you say, the average age is 74 and younger women aren't joining, what does that say about the future of the church? There are a lot of Catholics in the United States who want to remain Catholics, who want to feel connected, who are deeply connected to it. What do you think best serves the future of the church, and can it modernize?
I think that if the church is going to survive and thrive, it needs to become big enough to contain a lot of different people, and that the emphasis on dogma does not serve that purpose. I actually don't really consider myself a Catholic anymore because I could no longer identify with the way the church was closing in on itself and the way that the dogma became so important. The Catholic Church is still very important to me, something that I feel very tied to in many ways, something that I'm very concerned about, something that, you know, for a great deal of my life meant a great deal to me. And I really do care what happens, but I can't identify with an institution that acts in ways that are so demeaning of human beings. That it was a very tough decision for me to make.
Sure.
You know, and when I look at these sisters, let's just imagine for a bit. So the average, the median age of a sister is 74. These are women who joined, you know, in the 1940s, 1950s,
right.
1960s. They've been serving ever since then. They lived through the tumult of the Vatican Council and watched as the numbers of their sisters dropped and dropped. After the Vatican Council, the number of sisters in the United States dropped to a third of what it had been. So these women who have stayed have been through all of that, and they've found ways to be of service. They've committed themselves completely. Now they're 74 years old, and they're being told they're not Catholic enough.
Mm. Youch.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really got to be tough. Again, we're talking with Mary Johnson about the church doctrine coming down. You say the church could modernize if it wanted. How could it do that and make itself more relevant and still remain the Catholic Church?
Well, I think part of the problem is that certain elements in the Catholic Church believe that nothing can ever change. That, you know, the Pope is infallible, and what the Pope says is just, you know, you can't play with it. And, of course, nobody's actually suggesting playing with it. But if you look, the Church at one time approved slavery. The Church, you know, all the Church does change. The Church at one time preached very firmly that the earth was the center of the universe, and they put people to death who disagreed.
True.
But now everybody knows.
Yeah.
What the reality is. So the church can change, but it would require an opening. It would require a spirit of humble dialogue that I don't see happening among the leadership of the church. It would mean that people would have to start listening, and the people here, I mean the people in charge, the bishops, the Pope, would have to become more open to the reality of the people on the ground. And I think they're missing an opportunity because the sisters are the ones who could provide that for them, because that's where the sisters are.
Mm-hmm. And it's been said that the Vatican leadership is just not used to having educated women form thoughtful opinions and actually engage in dialogue. But helping others is, I mean, that is the image of what nuns do, what the sisters do. Is the Vatican saying that the nuns, the sisters, should worry less about poverty and injustice and more about abortion and gay rights and, again, these sexual issues?
The bishops are miffed because the sisters haven't spoken out to support all of the bishops' agenda. The sisters, you know, have been concentrated on working with the poor, and I'm not sure that the bishops are saying, don't do that. But what the bishops are saying is, we need you to stand exactly with us on everything that we say. We need you to stand with us against marriage equality for same-sex marriages. We need you to stand with us very firmly, very vocally, to say that only men can be ordained in the Catholic Church. We need you to stand with us to say over and over and over again that abortion is wrong. And the sisters have been busy doing other things. And the sisters who work, you know, day by day with women who are in very difficult situations, the sisters who have, you know, during the 80s, the sisters were the very first people to start to help men who were dying with AIDS. The sisters know these men's stories. They've seen their relationships. They know that there's nothing wrong there. How can they speak up in the ways that the bishops do when they know the people who are affected by these issues? And it just becomes very difficult. And the bishops are kind of saying, come on our side and say these things vocally, or we will have to declare publicly that you are not Catholic enough.
Hmm.
They're kind of calling the sisters out, and the consequences could be very, very, very high for the sisters, because if any particular congregation of sisters are deemed at a certain point, you know, you are not Catholic enough, you do not belong to the church could take property, the church could take savings, the church, and these women would be left with nothing. When I left the Missionaries of Charity, after 20 years of service, I was given $500 and a plane ticket to start my new life.
How thoughtful.
This is, you know, and that's just one individual, very small. And I was 39 years old at the time. I was able to start a new life. I had a lot of help from my family.
Right.
What happens with these women, 74 years old, 75 years old, 80 years old, if they're told your convent is no longer yours, it now belongs to the archdiocese, you must leave.
Wow. Well, part of the, it's just mind-boggling to think about, and the heart comes into question here. Where is there a heart? And there's a new archbishop. Well, there's a new appointment, I should say, Archbishop J. Peter Sartain, I hope I pronounced it right, of Seattle.
Sartain, yes.
Sartain. What is his role in all this? What is his crack?
He's an archbishop in Seattle.
Yes.
And he is the one that the Vatican appointed to oversee the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. So the Leadership Conference represents 80% of the American sisters. It's made up actually of 1,500 leaders of the various groups of sisters from all over the country. Archbishop Sartain has been appointed to review the documents of this group and to actually revise their statutes.
Oh my.
He's been appointed to oversee all of the speakers who come to their annual conferences and their other meetings. He has to give approval for that. He's been assigned to review all of the associations of the group. For example, if the group works with another group, whether that's appropriate or not. And two of the groups that are named in the document are NETWORK, which is a social justice lobby, the one that stood up in support of the Affordable Care Act. And another is New Ways Ministry, which is a group that ministers to gay and lesbian people in the church. And so one of the things the bishop, Archbishop Sartain, is being appointed to do is to look and see kind of like who the sisters can hang out with. Are these people, for me, the whole thing reads kind of like we're grounding you. We are going to look at everybody that you're talking with.
Oh,
we're going to look at all of your communications. All the publications of this group are being reviewed. One of them has been polled already, and it's very interesting that the document says that the reason, the one reason that they specify and the example that they pull from this document is that the Leadership Conference of Women Religious held up as a model for settling disputes, a model of dialogue, where a sister who might have a difficulty of whatever sort would dialogue with the superiors back and forth, and together they would look for God's will in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the assessment that came down from the Vatican was, this is wrong. What a superior's duty is to insist that every sister comply completely with the Vatican. Dialogue is not the way to go.
you can't see me shaking my head. I'm just, it's amazing.
And you can't see me rolling my eyes in complete despair and almost unbelief. I wish I could unbelieve it, but this just rings very true to form for them. So the bishop has these duties to oversee basically the grounding of these sisters, of treating them, you know, as if they are errant teenagers.
Oh my God, it's so degrading. Oh.
Another one of the things that the document specifies is that the sisters should return to the catechism of the Catholic Church. Okay, these are sisters, many of whom have degrees in theology, who have been working in active ministry for years. But the Catechism of the Catholic Church is the document which is most often used to prepare adults for baptism in the Catholic Church. So it's like the most fundamental. And the church is saying, you know, don't think anymore about the deeper issues of theology. Go back to where everything is black and white. It really is treating these sisters as if they are children.
And life is a bit more gray. Well, let me ask you this. There was this fellow Jesus who, what was his history? I mean, this is what it's about, I would think.
One would hope so.
And I had
Wasn't
heard...
Wasn't he getting in trouble with religious authorities all the time?
That's true. And didn't he bring a woman forward during prayers to sit up front rather than to remain in the back where females had been relegated? Where is, you know, what would Jesus do?
Yes, isn't that an interesting question? You know, I think Jesus has been shaking his head at the Vatican for a while. but Jesus is the one who was, as I said, you know, always getting in trouble with religious authorities, and eventually they had him put to death.
Yeah. And Maureen Dowd recently wrote in the New York Times, she said the church leadership never recoiled in horror from pedophilia, yet it recoils in horror from outspoken nuns. We haven't brought this up during this discussion, but I wonder how much of a purposeful distraction this issue may be. I mean, people really care about this whole pedophilia stuff.
It's, of course, and rightly so.
Well, yeah. Is this? I mean, what's going on with the male leadership of the church that they're, you know, freaking out about women speaking up and focusing on the poor and injustice, and they've been protecting, you know, pedophilic priests before? Is this part of what's going on? They're trying to make a purposeful distraction?
It could be an element of distraction. It could also be a way of trying to find funds to replace the money that's been spent out on settlements to victims. If they can sell the sisters' convents, they could get money that way. There could be all sorts of connections. I can't really speculate exactly on the motives. Who knows? These things are all possible. And, of course, I can't speculate, but I can't say definitively whatever anybody is thinking. One thing that we haven't mentioned also is that there is this doctrinal assessment that's been made by the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith as a result of the investigation of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious.
Mm-hmm.
Simultaneously, there has been undergone in the United States a second investigation of American nuns, a very invasive investigation called an apostolic visitation. And this has been handled by a different branch of the Vatican, the congregation that's responsible for consecrated life. And this visitation involved very extensive questionnaires that were sent to the sisters, asking all sorts of questions, including things like, how do you treat a sister who is speaking up in dissent from official church teaching? There was a very large section asking for financial disclosures, which the sisters objected to for various reasons, and eventually some of those requirements of reporting about financial matters were pared down. But then there were this visitation where on-site inspections and dialogue with sisters where outsiders came into their convents asking them all these sorts of questions. And it was a very large three-year-long investigation. The report of that investigation was filed with the Vatican in January, and we're waiting to see what response the Vatican will give. Usually whenever there's an apostolic visitation afterwards, there's always a report, there are requirements, there are things that need to be changed. The Vatican takes some sort of action. And so this is just kind of like the first papal red slipper to drop. We're waiting to see what will happen with the other shoe.
Wow.
The Vatican's holding this up. That's over the heads of the sisters as well, that this is just the first in perhaps many responses by the Vatican.
Well, the sisters are not exactly being quiet. I mean, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious is understandably not speaking to the media right now because they're involved in the middle of it. That's certainly understandable, but they're not just doing nothing. I understand a special meeting coming up May 29th to June 1st of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. What's that going to be like? What results are expected?
Yes, no one knows what to expect from that. The sisters that I talked to don't have any idea of what decisions they will actually make. That will be a time for them to pray together, to talk together, to discuss together, to discern what their response should be. And at this point, no one knows what decisions will be made. And in the meantime, the sisters are talking among themselves. They're discussing, but yes, they're not talking to the media right now because they don't know what their official response will be.
Right, but they'll be. This meeting was called in reaction to the to the reprimand.
I
see. Well, that
it's called with a specific purpose of determining the the official response.
I wonder, again, about the future of the church, and I wonder if this crackdown, this muzzling of American nuns, I wonder if it'll result, if it will encourage an exodus by nuns from the church. What do you think?
You know, I don't know. I know that the sisters have emerged, especially after all of these various investigations, with a clear sense of their identity, of who they are, of which lines they're willing to cross and which they aren't. But the stakes are really very, very high for them. And for all of their members, they're going to have to be thinking about the 85, 90-year-old sisters who are in the retirement homes and how they're going to care for them. What would be the consequences of any sort of withdrawal? And certainly, that's not what they want. They've always considered themselves Catholics. They've dedicated themselves to the church. They hold the values of Catholicism so dear and it's what makes up the core of their identity.
Certainly. And I wonder, one group that, well, I've always been impressed for 30, 40 years or so with groups like the Sisters of Mercy, which bravely fight against injustice. And they've been criticized in the past, but people love what they do. And they really make a difference. And there's this other group, Voice of the Faithful, that's been real concerned about the church that they love because of the pedophile priest situation. I wonder if the Voice of the Faithful has gotten involved in this. Do you know at all? I don't.
I don't know if they've issued an official response. I know that people all over the world, Catholics and non-Catholics, have been sending letters of support to the sisters. There are online petitions that have been signed by thousands and thousands of people. Just yesterday, there was a letter of support to the LCWR from 34 different women's organizations in the United States, most of which were not Catholic. These organizations sending their support to the sisters. Sisters in the Philippines, sisters in Ireland have sent support. Just people all over, Jewish people who have come forward saying that they support the sisters. I go online every day and look to see, and there are more and more people always coming forward to say, you are standing with the poor people, the people who have no voice. We want to stand with you.
Yes.
And it's a universal thing. Nicholas Kristof's column in the New York Times on Sunday had the heading, "We are all nuns." It is the way that people have found connection with the sisters, and in ways that they don't connect with often priests in the same ways, because the sisters have been so close to people.
Yeah, and I wonder what's going on in the congregations now. I mean, certainly the difference between a priest visibility and the nun's visibility in a community is, quite different. And what do you hear from congregations? I imagine there's a lot of rumblings throughout the land.
There are rumblings in various senses, and people are just upset. They're standing in support of the sisters. They'd like to know what's going on. There was a Florida bishop who came forward recently with a blog post, actually, trying to lend support to the sisters. So it's not that all of the priests and the bishops have been completely silent, but they risk retaliation if they speak up in favor of the sisters in one way or another. Father James Martin, who is the editor of America Magazine, a Jesuit, extremely highly visible, very influential, very well-liked priest, who has come forward and spoken in support of the sisters. So it's not that, everyone in the official church is silent. People all over are coming forward in support of the sisters.
Well, what can people do? They can certainly, if they're Catholic, they can, connect in whatever way with their local churches. But we have this thing called the Internet these days. How can people best express?
There's a Facebook page, Support Our Sisters, that people can go and like that Facebook page and then get news about it. And also the more people who like that page, that's kind of like making an online petition. There is an online petition at change.org where people can sign up to express their support for the sisters. One of the things that some people are encouraging to do is to send a letter to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, the group that issued this edict, just expressing their support for the sisters. Those sorts of political actions can be taken relatively easily.
Well, people's voices do matter, and I'm, you know, I can't help but be reminded of the split within the Episcopal Church about the ordination of an openly gay priest, and there is a split, and both sides are going forward. I wonder if there may be any kind of a split after this. I don't know. It's a bit different.
It's entirely possible. Who knows? Well, I really wouldn't wish such a thing.
No, no.
But, you know, it's who knows what might happen.
Well, we'll see.
You
about...
would think that the Catholic Church could be big enough to include all sorts of people, and especially these who have dedicated themselves so selflessly over decades.
And the difference that's been made in the lives of the poor throughout the world by these selfless nuns, you know, that can't help but be strengthening to their church, I would think. So this is quite a crossroads that the Catholic Church is right now. Well, thank you, Mary Johnson. Very, very informative. We spent 20 years with the Missions of Charity, new Mother Teresa here, and boy, it's going to be interesting from here on out. You know, we have these men holding on to power in different various ways, and it seems like that may be simply part of it. What do you think?
I believe it's a good part of it, and unfortunately so.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today on the Bert Cohen Show, and let's wish the best of luck to the sisters out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert.
All right. Love to hear from you. Email me, Bert@bertcohen.com.